Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Hi, and welcome to Sorceress, a podcast where I chat with authors and audiobook narrators about books, and especially audiobooks in the urban fantasy category. If you dig wisecracking wizards, conflicted lycanthropes, antagonistic undead, and all those other things that go bump in the night and then get bumped back, you're in the right place. So make yourself comfortable, salt the doors and the windowsills, and join me, James Anderson Foster, as we get to know the creators of this fascinating genre. Okay, so tonight I'm joined by Paul Woodson. Paul Woodson has narrated over 150 audiobooks in many genres, including World War II European history, American history, contemporary and historical romance, fantasy, science fiction, classics, and young adult. With a BFA from Boston University's School for the Arts, Paul spent many years as a professional AEA and SAG-AFTRA actor, working on stage and occasionally on film across the USA and Europe before becoming a full-time voice artist and audiobook narrator. His facility in German and French has garnered him much work in narrating European World War II histories, and his early years in the UK, where he began reading at the age of 3, and facility with accents, have led to his narration of many British titles. Man, that's a lot of stuff, Paul.
I tried to pack a lot into a short couple of sentences.
So how long did you live in the UK?
Just a couple of years when my dad was a grad student at Cambridge when I was really young, like before I started school in the United States. So really before I was 5.
Wow.
So very, very young.
Still, but those are like formative years there.
They're formative years. They, you know, I always, they say I was talking with a bit of a British accent when I came back. Which obviously I lost, but I always felt like it was accessible. I mean, and a lot of my life has been steeped in Anglophilia, I guess you could say. So I've always had the accent nearby, or at least some of them.
Mm-hmm. missiles,
especially
missiles or missiles.
Missile.
There we go.
Say missile.
My son, my oldest, grew up watching Doctor Who, the new Doctor Who reboot.
Yeah.
David Eccleston started the year Dogan was born, and I want to say he was like 11 before he realized that we don't pronounce it missile. He'd only ever heard it in Doctor Who, so yeah, missile and mobile.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think you'll find a lot of the ile endings get pronounced that way, ile instead of ill. There's a lot of the endings are some of the key differences, some of the suffixes and such.
The things they get wrong about English.
There's just all these really minor differences that most people wouldn't think of. Like people can get the lilt of the accent, or they can get the kind of cadence, but there's all these like syllable shifts, you know. Mm-hmm. For example, like narrator in the US is narrator in the UK and such, you know, and a lot of syllable shifts end up going to the second to last syllable, where we stress the first syllable.
I'm always screwing up the syllables.
I hate you.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually saw a video on YouTube, a dialect coach, who was dissecting like 10 well-known movie actor accents, and you know, talking about what they've done great and what they screwed up on, and it was so incredibly minute. I mean, there were times where he'd be like, okay, here's what this vowel should sound like, and he would play it, and you know, it should sound like ooh,
right.
And he says it like ooh, and I'm like, those are the same. Like, I literally cannot hear anything. But he's like, no, you can totally tell that this guy's not a native speaker because of that. And
I think I've watched that same video, as a matter of fact. I can't remember who the coach was, but yeah, they were very particular and very specific. It's, you know, down to the placement in the mask of where the vowel went.
Yeah.
Even if the sound comes out roughly the same, they didn't place it in the left nostril. you know.
And exactly.
New Zealanders always place it in the lower right mandible. I don't
It's, you know, and I'm watching this thing and I'm like, you know, on the one hand, I could see how like hiring, and I assume this is like so that people will hire him to prepare mm-hmm. for acting roles. And I could see where, you know, if I spent a few months with him on an accent, I would totally nail it, right? I you know, I feel like he knows what he's doing. So in that sense, sure, his video is super helpful for him. On the other hand, there's also like this massive voice in the back of my head saying, but who would care? Really, who right. would even, who but this guy would even notice that you placed the accent properly in the left nostril? Literally no one but that guy.
Well, so. And possibly the people whose accent it is, maybe. They're the ones who are going right. to call you on it first if it's a very specific local dialect. But
right, yeah,
but all no of one the else will.
It's amazing. if we narrate a book that is set in a specific geographical location, and God help us if they mention the neighborhood, everybody in that neighborhood will listen to the book. And if you've if they have a dialect of any kind, and you have screwed up mm-hmm. anything, they're all going to go on Audible and leave a review for you.
There is the handful. Yes, I've seen it happen.
I've heard of it happening.
I've had it happen where they're wrong. That's a whole other story.
Oh yeah.
Well, I mean, right? There's a book I did that had a kind of, it's a fantasy world and it's set in a kind of old fashioned Edwardian setting, and I did it in British dialects and I used a slightly more old-fashioned pronunciation of the word bade. We would say he bade him come to the hall, and I said I pronounced it bad because in that style that is what they used to say, and that is how some people still say it, especially the classical actors and so forth, and it was suitable to that setting, but someone jumped on me for pronouncing it that way. Even though that was a conscious choice.
Yeah. I had a book where the author, I mean, it was a urban fantasy, but the author made up certain names, right? Invented the name, told me how to pronounce it. I pronounced it, and people still complain that I got it wrong. And I'm like, how, you know, like, what are you basing that on? But whatever. People are funny.
How do you pronounce? Yeah, a made up name. Well, or as someone would say, all names are made up. but a name that's not common. Yeah. How do you get that wrong?
Exactly.
Unless they know the author personally and had some kind of conversation with them over tea, and the author is very, you know, upset about it. I don't know.
You know, there are times where I wish that, you know, we could respond to reviews on Audible. And right. then almost immediately after, I am deeply grateful that we can't.
Yes. No, I
Oh, man. So you were stage and screen actor.
Mm-hmm.
Before becoming primarily voiceover. So
mm-hmm.
what prompted the shift, and what did you do before you got behind the mic?
Let's see. Well, I'd gone to Boston U actually originally to study classical voice as a singer, and decided that I wasn't completely committed to the whole lifestyle of classical music. I liked opera. I had done some opera, operetta, but I really was more, my heart was always more on the theater side of things. So I re-auditioned for their theater school and got in and got a BFA in theater, and then kind of kicked around New York for a long time doing, you know, getting into the unions, doing shows, touring the country, going to Europe a couple times, doing tours over there, like Music of Andrew Lloyd Webber, that kind of thing. And so I got to travel quite a lot. I mean, like many actors, I got to do more shows outside New York by being in New York than I ever did in New York. Although I did my share of things here and there. You know, I did a show twice off Broadway, but at a reputable off Broadway house, playing Vincent van Gogh in a really well-written, modern, sung-through musical about van Gogh.
Nice. You have no idea how disappointed I am that you didn't say Van Gogh.
Oh. For clarity's sake in the English language, yes, I could say Van Gogh, Van Gogh. Like you're choking on a piece of matzah, but or something. But yeah, no, the Dutch is a bit of a harsh language. So no, I suppose if I was being proper, I should have said Van Gogh. Van Gogh. My Dutch is not up to snuff, I would.
You know, I know a coach.
Yeah, I saw him on YouTube.
So how'd you make your way to voice acting?
Oh, it was just, well, it started kind of by accident. I was, you know, I wasn't doing so much stage anymore, especially as I got into my early 40s. It was, you know, harder to get cast, and I was working still, you know, as a union actor and like as a stand-in or background on a lot of shows and films and taking side jobs, but, you know, not particularly satisfying any of that. Mm-hmm. And I'd always listened to audiobooks for, you know, decades since I was probably a teenager, but, you know, I had never been a voiceover artist. I knew that was a whole other world, and I never tried to get into that because I knew how competitive it was. But audiobooks, I don't know. I mean, like a lot of people, I first encountered ACX somehow, I think through a SAG Foundation YouTube video, you know, already being a member of SAG, I was always looking for stuff that intrigued me.
And for folks that don't know, just to interrupt real quick, SAG is the Screen Actors Guild.
Yes, Screen Actors Guild, which has since merged with AFTRA, so now it's SAG-AFTRA, and AFTRA is technically the union contract that we have as union performers, but they're merged. And the SAG Foundation video I saw had like Scott Brick and Hilary Huber and Pat Fraley. And of course, back then I had no idea who they were. You know, now they're like gods to me, of having learned, you know, the hierarchy of the lovely audiobook world and how talented and, you know, giving they all are too. I just watched it and I was intrigued, and they mentioned ACX as a place where some people could, you know, at least look. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know there was an open market to submit yourself for these audios. And so I just thought I'd give it a try. And of course I went in, did everything absolutely wrong. But I still got work like right away, like paying work, and probably before I was ready, you know, but I figured, well, I'm an actor. I've been a singer. I know how to use a microphone. I know how to use audio software because I used to make musical recordings, you know, on my own. So yeah, I can do this. And so I probably still had an advantage over 60% of the people out there, but there was so much that I was backwards on. And I'm just glad that I kinda was able to change up everything quickly from the beginning, and all those great communities on Facebook and online, other and the forums, and kind of giving advice, sharing advice, and giving the snark, which helps get you on the right road rather quickly if you're humble enough to listen. And kind of just upped my game bit by bit, and now it's turned into a full-time gig, and it's actually going a lot better than my regular acting career ever had. I mean, knock wood, I hope it stays that way. I'm working full-time, yeah. And I'm only in with a couple places, so I'm still, frankly, I haven't pushed myself to the others that much. I'd love to. I've just, every time I think about sending out the mails, I get like three new projects, and I'm like, well, even if they wanted me, I'd have to say, well, not for 3 or 4 months, guys.
Yeah.
It's a good problem to have, but I shouldn't get complacent, because, you know, I would love to work eventually for everybody and, you know, be diverse in the companies I work with.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in an industry like this, all it takes is for one or two casting directors to not think of you for a title. Yeah. Fortunately for you, you are incredibly talented.
Oh,
and
thanks.
I don't see things slowing down for you at all. which, you know, I say with some amount of worry and trepidation because you and I work for the same publishers. Mm. And so, yeah, I keep thinking, you know, every book that Paul gets is one I'm not narrating.
But I don't think you're in any danger either, right? of it slowing down.
Knock on wood.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned you're doing this full time. Mm. And, you know, this really makes you one of those rare unicorns, which is a paid working actor.
I know. It's weird, right?
Isn't it? And so, but my question behind this, though, is, what did you have to sacrifice to get here, to get to this point?
Hmm. Well, that's a good question. Well, I mean, when I was younger, I probably wouldn't have wanted to do this because, you know, as a theater artiste, I think it was all about craving the freedom and wanting to get out and, you know, I do kind of miss the camaraderie of stage and of, you know, putting together a show, but I also kind of feel like theater has a lot of dry spells, or at least it can when you're me. And, you know, I don't know. I've always, what did I give up? I was about to drift into another topic. What did I give up? I don't know. Right now I'm actually enjoying the ride because, you know, I had a lot of debt to pay off and I was able to do that. And, I'm able to travel more than I used to be, and I love traveling. It's kind of one of the things I got into acting for, was one of the side perks is you would often get to do a show elsewhere. You know, it got me to mm-hmm. Germany and France and technically France, Germany, Austria, Switzerland.
Yeah, we don't go on many narration tours.
No, but you know what I get to do is a lot of like audiobook conventions or signings or little things like that.
Do you have any coming up?
Yeah. I just decided to commit to going over to Love in Vegas, for a day in obviously Las Vegas in October, which, one of the host of a site called Oral Fixation, which is a great romance oriented, online website and Facebook group with tons of fans. They are having a narrator group come to their table at Love in Vegas and doing like meet and greets and signings and so forth. And I think I'm going to be one of about 7 or 8 narrators who show up. Yeah.
Nice.
That's and awesome. So that's coming up. A few of us just did Romantic Times in Reno back in May. And again, you know, great opportunity to travel. It's a business trip, so, you know, you get to ride it off, but you also get to have some fun, you know. And, nice. Yeah, I mean, it's an expense out of your own pocket, but if you're working enough to justify it, ideally, it's also going to garner you more work. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's nice. So this is actually a really great segue into, you know, the general theme of this podcast. You mentioned Oral Fixation is, you know, mostly romance and then romantic times, did you say?
Yes, that was the convention. Last one, actually. But that's another story.
You've done, a lot of romance titles. And if you're a fan of that genre, you know that, it feels like, you know, a solid 7/10 of it takes place in the Scottish Highlands. And there's some sort of like, I don't know if it was Outlander that started it or if it's just the most popular, example of this, but you know, there's Scotsmen, mm-hmm. there's the Highlands, there's kilts, there's mm-hmm. romance, and there's magic,
there
which
is.
Brings us right into urban fantasy.
Aha, good segue.
thank you. So, you know, you've done so much stuff. I mean, even in the bio I mentioned, you know, you've got World War II history, European histories over here. And then, you know, Scottish Highland, romance, mm-hmm. magic. And all, you know, it's how is it narrating these?
It's a lot of fun. It's not a genre that I read for the most part before I was narrating them. But now that I do, they're actually books I enjoy giving life to and giving voice to, and the characters are usually right out of theater. You know, they're all characters that you're sort of familiar with just from doing shows. You have the great heroes and heroines. You have sometimes the wizards or the witches and the villains. Sometimes they're English, because when you're in Scotland, the villains are often English. Sometimes they're also Scottish. Sometimes they are American. I'm doing a whole time travel series by Jenny Vale, which calls into mind calls forth my particular skills, which is to do English, Scottish, and American dialects all in the same book, and about equal parts of all. And so, you know, nice. You need someone who can carry all those voices through. Yeah.
And the Americans the bad guy.
In some cases, but sometimes, often the Americans are the heroes brought to medieval Scotland via magic, and then they have a romance with the folk there. And actually, it goes both ways. We've had the medieval Scots end up in modern San Francisco and then have romances in modern times. So you get the sort of the whole fish out of water story, which is always fun. But that's one series. I mean, I've also done some that don't involve magic, that are just steadfastly set in the Scottish Highlands in a certain time and place. And those are great. I don't know. A lot of them really feel more like adventure stories to me than romances. I mean, the ones I do have, you know, a bit of sex and, you know, sexy times, but they don't go heavy on it. So much of the story is simply an adventure, with perhaps a man and woman coming together as the centerpiece of the story. But, you know, certainly not what I thought romance novels were all about. But as I started doing more and more, I've come to realize that romance novels, hell, man, they're everything. There is every genre of story and fiction exists within the romance genre. So, you know, you have adventure romance, you have war romances, you have Scottish and English and French and German and Canadian romances, and, you know, they span all time periods, they span all subgenres. So I've come to realize that it can be anything you want. Yeah.
I know there was a time when it was almost like narrating romance was, you know, kind of it, but I don't talk about it. Kind of, you know, it was like treated like the stepchild that we don't want to acknowledge.
Right. There's always been a kind of double standard on them, I think. Yeah.
But there's been, I think, a recognition. I will honestly say, I think the fans are responsible for this, because the genre in both print, digital book, and audiobook, the romance genre is massively huge, and money talks. People listen to it.
Oh, yeah.
But it's really, I think, garnered a lot of respect as people have followed the money, actors, and then realized, oh, well, this is actually a really good story.
Yeah, exactly. And there really are no limits as to what a romance can be about. I mean, people find their subgenre within that genre and go for it.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, it's you don't get much more fundamental to the human condition than relationships.
True. Very true.
You know, and so you have this genre that it really is just exploring this incredibly important facet of the human condition, and then it does it in a wide array of settings and situations. So
yeah. So true.
Yeah, and my wife got me hooked on the Outlander TV series.
Oh, nice. You know, I've never actually watched it. I probably should, as research.
No, it's really good. I enjoyed it. She's listened to all the audiobooks. Davina Porter?
Yeah, she narrates the series, yeah.
And just fantastic. Just such a great job. I've decided I need to go and listen to all the books, just because it's a great story. And I mean, she's just such an amazing narrator. You know, I want to listen to the whole thing and listen to how she brings people along on this, this rather long tale. Speaking of which,
yeah,
I want to talk about The Horror on the Links.
Yeah, sure. Let's talk about it.
Because this book, is, what is it, like a billion hours long?
When I recorded it, it was my longest audiobook to date. Since then, I have actually surpassed it. But I believe it clocked in around 28 hours. And it's something like 20 or 21 short stories, all by the same author. And this is volume one of five.
And this is old school urban fantasy, yeah, supernatural.
Old school
stuff.
Paranormal detective, which was still treading new ground at the time. I mean, yeah, some other story writers had covered these topics, but they still weren't well-known tropes, you know, in the movies like they are today. Zombies and mummies and werewolves. I mean, they were written about, but they were just sort of finding their foothold at that point. In fiction, and this series has a great sense of humor, which I enjoyed. You know, you have the French detective who, Jules de Grandin, who's like the smartest guy in every situation, but he's also irascible and very French, and you know, it was a challenge because the first story describes him as having not much of an accent, but then he will always slip into Frenchisms throughout. Anytime he gets excited, you know, so I had to make a choice and decided to make him not with your typical French accent, but still I gave him something, but it ended up being more of a distinguished, you know, very, very slight French accent like this. So you may not know that he's French, but you know that he's not from here. You know, he's someone.
So not quite Hercule Poirot.
Not quite Hercule Poirot, no. Although I did enjoy Branagh's latest turn of that.
Oh,
playing that card.
Yeah.
Saw that.
Have you listened to him doing the audiobook?
No, but I would welcome that.
Oh, it is so good. It's it was so good it hurt me as a performer, you know.
Yeah, I should put it on the list. Yeah. I actually had not ever read or seen Murder on the Orient Express till rendition. So I actually felt like I got to appreciate it completely fresh, not knowing the twists and turns of the plot.
Well, and you know, they update the story a little bit for the movie.
I figured some of those were modern touches.
There's enough new in the book that, oh yeah, you gotta listen to it. That's so yes.
But I was comparing Jules de Grandin, I guess, a bit to Hercule Poirot, and they have their similarities and differences. And then he has his sidekick, Dr. Trowbridge, who is actually the one telling all the stories in first person.
So kind of a very, like a Holmes and Watson thing.
It is like a Holmes and Watson, only the Watson is incredibly dull and dim. I mean, I think it's more because they go through adventure after adventure and Trowbridge never seems to sharpen up, like finally starting to see that the impossible may be possible. And every time they come across something weird, he just doesn't get it. And you'd think that by the 12th or 13th story, he'd start saying, oh, this reminds me of that other case, de Grandin. But no, he's just like, wow, this is impossible. I'm dashed if I know what's going on here. But then I realized, because it was all written as, periodical fiction for a magazine, it had to deliver the same thing again and again. And so someone who picked up one copy of Weird Tales magazine should be able to read one story anywhere you jump in and not have to, read the others to know what it's about. But I had a great deal of fun reading those, and still hoping. I know I didn't get to do volume two, but since there are five and they're re-releasing them all as books and print editions and audio, I think, I'm hoping to get another stab at least at one of the volumes.
Nice.
Yeah, because that was one of my favorites to narrate. And it was an author I'd never even heard of before I got approached.
You know, and until this book came out, it was last year, early this year?
Oh, God. It was, I think it was early this year. Yeah.
Yeah. But they just started, like, last year, like, I think, republishing these.
Yeah.
And in another interview, I was commenting, I think that when I was talking to Paul Stokes, mm-hmm. The reviewer, I had mentioned that, you know, Jim Butcher's Harry Dresden mm-hmm. was, like, the progenitor of this, like, what we think of really as the mainstay of urban fantasy, which is the supernatural detective with, you know, liberal doses of humor thrown mm-hmm. in. But then, you know, just as you started talking, I was like, oh, wait a minute. These came out in, like, was it the early 1920s, yeah. mid-1920s, something like
Volume 1 is entirely from the 1920s, and Seabury Quinn yeah. kept writing the stories all the way through the 1950s, but the volume I covered, yeah, starts back in early 1920s.
So, yeah, I have to completely take back what I said about, you know, Jim Butcher may be the modern, mm-hmm. the father of the modern urban fantasy genre, but the supernatural detective, especially, mm-hmm. I mean, wisecracking, you know,
yes.
smart, sidekick, humor, yeah, that mm-hmm. at least goes back to the 1920s now.
Oh, yeah. And what's great is they're not all supernatural stories. They all have that bent in them somewhere, but mm-hmm. some actually have almost a Scooby-Doo plot where you're supposed to think it's a supernatural force and then it's just a guy in a mask, you know? So they'd really, the author is throwing you curveballs sometimes, even as you go from story to story. It's not always the supernatural. Sometimes it's just a crook or someone pretending to be a ghost, and other times it's an actual ghost or an actual zombie. So you never really know what you're going to get, which is kind of cool.
So and, how much fun was it doing not only these stories, but doing them, in such bulk, almost nearly 30 hours, that takes up, if for folks who don't know, the amount of time that goes into just 1 hour of audio is enormous. You know, if you don't count the research time and the pre-reading time, if you just count time behind a microphone, it's at least 2 hours for every 1 hour usually.
Mm-hmm. And often more.
Yeah.
For pre-read and research and everything.
Yeah. So you lived with Jules de Grandin for a long period of time while you were doing this.
Yeah, fortunately, I recorded it in the winter, so I was just holed up in my apartment the whole time, either reading or narrating the stories. It was actually great. It was, and I've done longer books now of history or and such, so I can tell you the fantasy is a lot more fun to do a book of that length, or fantasy or paranormal or horror. But
what's it like spending that much time in Jules's head, being, you know, the supernatural detective?
You know,
did it affect you at all?
Maybe a bit. I think actually I just put a bit of myself into Jules, you know, the smartass side, and just gave him a bit of a French flavor. He's written in very specific terms, you know. You know, he has the French kind of Frenchisms and the attitude, but he's also, he likes to eat and he likes to assume that he needs to explain his whole story to everybody. And, you know, I don't know. I think I just took some of my snottier side, but the amiable snotty side, the smart ass, I guess, and put him into Jules de Grandin. Then I took my the persona that I usually come off as in my outer self, which is the kind of, the Homer Simpson, and made that Dr. Trowbridge. So he had both sides of my id, or is it the ego? No, ego working. Or no, the ego and the id working opposite each other. Am I getting that wrong? I always get those mixed up.
You know what? Freud's completely discredited by now anyway, so it doesn't matter.
That's true. But no, living in their world was actually a hell of a lot of fun. And it was actually not as hard as it seems, because every story had a consistency to the characters. Trowbridge was always the same kind of thick-headed conservative doctor. De Grandin was always the sprightly smart Frenchman, and then there was always the Irish police sergeant who lived in their town who came to them for help. Always the same guy. They had the maid was always the same. So you did have 6 or 7 recurring characters. And then what made it so much fun was each story then also had new characters, and they seemed to come from pretty much all over the globe. So, you know, that gave me another series of opportunities to create a bunch of new people. But because a lot of them are, you know, they're only in the one tale, I didn't have to worry as much about the consistency from story to story because they were just in one story. Sure. And I think I did every dialect on the planet at some point in that book. And then in one of the tales, one of my favorites is near the beginning. It almost seems like a story out. It could be early James Bond. Like they're on a boat and it gets sunk by the villain and they end up trapped on a deserted island that the villain runs and he has these henchmen and then he's going to feed them to an octopus and he has a sexy native dancer. Or I'm sorry, no, she's actually from England, but he's kidnapped her. So they think she lives in the, what is it, Papua New Guinea. That's where they are. And then the guy, their host, it's the whole typical most dangerous game kind of scenario. You know, he seems like this friendly, charming sort. He's an Englishman. But then gradually you realize he's just like twisted and evil through the course of one long monologue. And there's cannibalism and there's everything. And it's all in that one story. Wow. And, yeah, and I got to make use of my British dialects there, and for that guy had monologues that went on for pages, you know. And of course, I do whole books in British dialect, so that's nothing new. But it's kind of cool when you get that departure, like you're doing a book entirely in one accent, but then for half a story, you're suddenly in another dialect, and that's where these things come into play. I guess those are. This is where we play our assets. You know, other people have other skills that I couldn't touch.
Sounds like you played your assets off there.
I sure did. I wish I could remember the title of that story within the book, but it's one of my favorites in that volume. And it's near the beginning. I want to say it's the second or third.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
So jumping ahead a few years, there's another supernatural series you did written by Pippa DaCosta, the Soul Eater series.
The Soul Eater series. I enjoyed those a lot, too.
Oh, I loved that series.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that. How did that come about?
Well, Tantor approached me to do book one, and then that kind of led to book two and book three. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard of it. Before they offered it to me, but I got into it right away because I loved the concept of, you know, and it's, I suppose other novels have done this with Greek and Roman gods. There's a novel called Gods Behaving Badly that I really loved the audiobook of, with Rosalind Landor narrating, mm-hmm. Which has the Roman gods living in modern day London. Well, this has Egyptian supernatural beings and gods and goddesses living in modern day New York, and you know, they're immortals, they never die, they've just lived through the centuries in various forms. And our hero, well, he's actually anti-hero, Ace, I believe.
Yeah,
I don't have my page in front of me for reference. It was a couple years ago.
That's all right. I'm a huge fan, and I'll happily remind you.
He is a fascinating kind of dark soul. I mean, he's a soul eater, which, if I remember right, it's he was who the gods used to send souls to for eternal decimation. Like, you know, everyone has a soul, but he would actually destroy the soul.
Yep. Their souls would be weighed, and their fate would be determined.
Yes.
And yeah, if your soul weighed more than the feather of Ma'at, congratulations, you got eaten. So I'm curious, excuse me, when working on a series like this, did you have any communication with the author?
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, and if you did, and I guess actually I should let you answer that because it'll affect the "and if you did" part. Cause if you didn't, then yeah.
Well, it's kind of funny. You know, you never know if you will or not when you work with a publisher. And in this case, I did, or they gave me her email. Mm-hmm. And I said, hi, glad to be doing your book. And if you have any names or character notes you want to give me, let me know. And she said, I'm cool with your interpretation. Glad you're narrating it. It was as simple as that. And then I did everything pretty much according to my own interpretation.
Nice. Those are always wonderful communications to get.
And that's not to say that I'm not trying to say Pippa was indifferent or didn't care. I think she just put her trust in me to do the material justice. And
which I think you did beautifully.
Oh, thank you. My wife loves that series too. Actually, the two books we've talked, or the two things we've talked about most on the show, are the ones my wife likes the most. So that's saying something.
It says your wife has excellent taste.
Indeed, she does. She's got me after all.
Exactly. Well, I was going to ask if you got like any heads up about story arcs, or if basically you were left to discover it as you got the new book. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you were left to.
I guess if I, it didn't really, nothing really threw mm-hmm. me as I got into books 2 and 3. So fortunately, I didn't have to like rethink any of the characters' voicings. Sure. You know, I even made some non-standard choices, well, that some might consider non-standard for the material. You know, because we have what is it? Osiris and God, who's the other god? The god,
which
her husband, Osiris, and you know, the he's a bad one.
Set, Anubis.
There is Set, but that's not who are you? The one I'm thinking of. Damn it. It'll come to me.
Okay.
In any case, they're like in this world, they're the mayor of New York and his wife and, you know, Thoth or Tote, depending on who you go to for pronunciation. He's like a high powered, is he a banker or a lawyer? He's one of the two.
He was a lawyer. No. He was a lawyer. Yeah, he was a lawyer. He was a lawyer.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so forth. And I gave everyone different voices, and I made the two hoity-toity ones, the top gods, British, even though they're in New York, just because the whole story is through Ace's POV, and he's lived throughout the millennia as well. And I just figured this is how he hears them. This is how he's known them all his existence. You know,
Isis and Osiris would absolutely.
Isis, that's, thank you. Yeah. Isis and Osiris.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes. Isis is the woman.
Yes.
I was getting mixed up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
They would have British accents.
It just seemed, fit. I mean, I could have gone another way and I could have made them, you know, the Trumps or something. But I opted to keep them in that British royalty kind of class. But I didn't do that with all the gods because they each had their own kind of flavor, you know. Yeah. And Ace has his. He has his lover, Bastet, who I kind of made this sort of, I thought of a mid-Atlantic, like, classy dame, I don't know why, from, mm-hmm. like, you know, Golden Age of film, even though, again, that's, she's far from, far before that, but she just had that image to me, and that's...
Well, there was kind of a noirish feel to, I mean, Ace the detective.
Oh, it is, definitely a detective noir. Ace is the film noir detective, and you know, it even follows a lot of the same story arcs. You know, he gets played for a fool, and then he gets has to avoid the axe, so to speak, and solve the mystery and put things right. Actually, you know, now that it's been a couple years since I did these, I'm remembering how much I enjoyed voicing him, but yeah, I actually use a couple of their samples on my SoundCloud page still, because I really enjoyed some of the work I did, and specifically the relationship between Ace and what's his girl Friday, his secretary. And again, it's slipping my mind, but they have this great kind of relationship that, even though it never seems like there's any flirtation in there, I felt there was. I mean, I'm not even sure if it was written, but I put it in the subtext anyway, because it just worked better, I thought. And for some reason, I kept picturing Kristen Ritter as that character, I don't know why. And you know how sometimes you just get an image in your head of a certain actor or actress playing this role. And even though I'm never going to be that person, I'm not going to do an impersonation. But if I have that in my head, then some approximation of what I'm thinking will come out in the voice. Because yeah. I'm not an impersonator. I mean, I can do my some funny character voices, but they're usually nondescript. You know, there'll definitely be a character voice. People will be like, well, who is that?
Right.
It's like, oh, that was my Homer Simpson. I'm like, that wasn't Homer Simpson. It was something, but it wasn't Homer Simpson. But it was certainly some other voice.
I'm sorry.
Maybe that's why I'm doing this.
Can you do that again?
Well, actually, that wasn't. I was trying to do a bad Homer Simpson voice.
Of course, yes.
So I don't know what my real one would be. My wife says I did a fairly good one.
Oh, man.
Usually I try to impersonate one character or person, and then I come off sounding like a third, like another person.
Well, yeah, but that works out because then nobody accuses you of trying to impersonate somebody.
Right.
You just do fantastic character work.
Right.
Yeah. So considering there's so much of this kind of fantasy, supernatural stuff in a lot of the fiction work that you do, is it an interest of yours genre wise, or is it just one of those things where, you know, you got cast for it, you're good at it, so people just keep casting you?
It certainly is one that I am interested in more on my own. Before I did audiobooks, I read a lot of fantasy and sci-fi growing up, although I can't remember specific books. If you were to ask me to name one, I never became like a genre kid or a, you know, I'd never had to have the complete, you know, Asimov or anything, but I've read a few books. It's like that.
So you were a casual fan.
I dabbled in a little of Asimov. Nice. And
so
a little Tolkien, a little Michael Ende. There's an underrated. Well, actually, he didn't write that many books, but he wrote The Neverending Story in German, and that is still one of the best kids' fantasy novels.
Oh my God, yeah! For folks that have only seen the movie and not read the book, do yourself a favor and pick it up or get the audio book. I'm sure it's out there. Such a better book than movie, I thought.
Yes, and they kind of, I think the movie is quite good, but. That all the sequels kind of failed. But the movie was only the first half of the book.
Right. They stopped. And considering the sequels.
They made a lame attempt to incorporate some things from the second half in the sequels. But by the third, you know, you have Jack Black as a motorcycle bully or something. And who knows what's that? Teenage. Yeah. And I love Jack Black. Don't get me wrong. But. They had lost their thread at that point.
Yeah, lost the
plot. They had changed Bastion's Empress and Atreus three times, and you can't do that.
No. You know, yeah, when your leads say they're not coming back for the sequel, that should tell you something.
Especially when they grow up and they're too old to do it anymore.
So talking about the books that you loved as a kid, one of the questions I'm asking everybody is, were you a weird kid?
I think I was. Yeah, definitely.
In what way? What made you weird?
I don't know. I kept to myself for a lot of my childhood. I mean, I didn't really get out of my shell till like high school when I discovered theater and, you know, kind of, I mean, I had friends once I was in like fourth or fifth grade, but actually up to that point, I didn't have a whole lot of school friends either. And I was an only child until my mom remarried. You know, but for most of my childhood, effectively, I was an only child. So I did have a lot of alone time, and I read a lot. I had a rich fantasy life. I used to play make-believe, and, you know, I actually used to write a bit myself. I mean, I still do, but not professionally. But, you know, always had a flair for, you know, the fantastical or the absurd or, I don't know. But I was weird. I'm trying to think of how to explain in what way, in the kind of way that people who don't spend a lot of time socially are weird. but then I was also that kind of kid who was also hurt that people didn't seem to get me, because I guess I was weird. And I, you know, there's the weird people who don't care. They're like, oh, screw you. I'm happy on my own. I actually did want to be like friends with everybody, but I was too weird to get there. And eventually I found a balance, you know, and I got out more and I met some girls and, you know, did some real life stuff. And then it all kind of balanced out. But I was a pretty weird kid.
Are you still weird now?
I'd say, yeah, but I'm also very conventional in a lot of ways, but I don't know. I'm still living a sort of double life as like a single life as sort of the bohemian artiste. Only now I work from my home and, you know, have an apartment full of knickknacks and thousands of books, of course. And
of course. Yeah. But see, and now you're getting paid for all your fantasy explorations. So, right.
I would say it was probably a natural fit because I remember here's how much of a weird kid I was. Ready? Mm-hmm. Like one of the first birthday parties I had with friends, like actual schoolmates over, which wasn't till I was about 10. I sat them all down and read them an Edgar Allan Poe tale.
That's
yeah, awesome. Lots of fun. When do we have the cake?
Oh man, yeah, but you know, it paid off.
It did. And actually, another thing I remember is I used to do readings for my English projects in school, like on tape, or I'd do it with another actor friend of mine in school, and we would record a book. We did like another Poe, like Cask of Amontillado. We recorded it for in audiobook style with another friend doing the characters and me being like the narrator, first the main character, and recorded it all and turned it in as the English project.
Oh my God.
'Cause, hey, it's proof that you read the book.
How in the world did it take you so long then to become a professional narrator? It sounds like from the time you were 10, you were just
like, was a kid.
Yeah.
But I guess the natural, the barrier to entry that I assumed was in all voiceover because it was hard enough as an actor and I had always heard that voiceover was 10 times as hard. And I think it is, but audiobooks are kind of in this netherworld in between. It's not the high stakes world of crazy voiceover. And I admit, I know very little about that world, but I do know that it's a different game. And I actually prefer a long, slow project where I can take my time and, you know, not have to yell.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, video games, actually, that could be fun work. But I hear people blow out their voices needing to give 150%.
Yeah. Video games are getting more fun. I mean, non-long form voiceover, commercial voiceover work. I think for the longest time, I don't think you could. God, I don't know. I'm gonna piss off people right now and say I don't think you could call it acting.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure it was. It's
plenty of voiceover artists who were not actors. They're like proud of it. They'll turn to me and they'll say, "Wait, how do you do? You do hours and hours in the booth reading? How do you do that?"
Yeah.
And these are professional voiceover artists, and I'm not dissing the voiceover people. I'm just saying it's two different ball games, and I think I probably prefer the books. I mean, I know I'm not making as much per minute for the recording, but in many ways, it's a more stable living, at least for now.
And you know, I find it more satisfying. I mean, I am an actor at heart, so I want to be acting. I want to be telling a story. And I think as video games become more cinematic, there's maybe more opportunity. Opportunity for that in the voiceover, but even then, from what I understand of it, not having like you not having done it, even then it's still just you're doing your lines and you're doing them over and over again, and you know it's so disjointed that you don't have the satisfaction of playing a character and you know acting that character through its arc and you know all of the things that. You know, we consider acting. I like the performance. Mm-hmm. So I get where you're coming from, I think. So what do you have coming up? What can people expect from you? This, you know, will air this maybe a month after recording it. So, you know, project ahead. Sure. What can people be expecting from you?
Well, let's see. I just wrapped recording on volume 2 of George Martin's biography.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, by Kenneth Womack. It's the volume 2 is called Sound Pictures. And volume 1 was released last year called Maximum Volume. So that's already out. And by the time this podcast airs, Sound Pictures should be out as well. And that was fascinating because he's best known as the Beatles producer, and he really did create a lot of their sound for them. I mean, often they would have an idea of what they wanted, but not how to implement it. And, you know, he would do that. He could, and they came up with a bunch of revolutionary studio techniques that, you know, we take for granted today. Or, I mean, the fact that Sgt. Pepper's was completely recorded on a 4-track tape recorder. All those sounds, all those tracks, and it was all just bumping tracks like I used to do with my old Tascam 4-track when I was recording music at home to, you know, just make tapes for fun of, yeah, and they did Sgt. Pepper's on a comparable system back in the 60s when that was top of the line. I don't know, so that was a good book just for getting, especially as someone who's been a Beatles fan all his life, and my parents too. That was fun for exploring a topic that I really am interested in. What else? I did, this is already out. My first book that was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. I still haven't done a Pulitzer Prize winner, but I did narrate Railroaded, which is about the Transcontinental Railroads, and it kind of explodes the myth of the railroad barons. I mean, we all tend to think of them as unscrupulous sorts anyway, but it revealed a lot about how the railroads just changed everything and were really built as a cash cow for these guys, and you know, damn the torpedoes otherwise, got a huge subsidy from the country and then just stole most of it. It's fascinating, and it was, you know, yeah, it's one of those things we think we know about, but then you don't really until you learn it in depth. So that is already out. And then on the fiction side, you know, I've done a couple male-male romances recently again. I have one called Snow Falling that's just been released, which I co-narrated with Joel Leslie. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Or, yeah, who is very popular in that genre. I don't have the same following. And I guess this is one way people can figure out who my pseudonym is, because I won't say it here, but you know, but by saying the title, you can look up that book and figure out what my alias is in certain genres. I mean, if I had it all to do again, maybe I wouldn't have even created an alias. But when I started out, I thought it would be better if I compartmentalized, because I didn't know what my future was going to be. Now I'd be like, well, who cares? But at the time,
it's okay, Clark Kent. Everybody knows you're super. The glasses are fooling no one.
And as always, I have a new Scottish or Highlander romance coming out by a couple of authors that I've worked with for several years, Kira Montclair and Jenna Vale. I'm narrating Jenna's fifth book right now, and there should be another Kira Montclair out sometime later. Well, one was just released, so Highland Retribution is a good one to check.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And can we look forward to more Soul Eater from you and Pippa DaCosta?
Oh, I would love that. I don't know yet. I think she has more books in that series, but I don't think they've been either they haven't been commissioned for audio yet, or I just don't know about it. She did approach me personally to ask about narrating one of her other books in another series, but it hasn't happened yet. But we were in touch about it.
Oh, fantastic.
I don't know. I'm not sure what's happening on that front, but we were in touch. I know that she liked my work enough to consider using me independently.
That's fantastic. So, you yeah. make a great pair.
Thank you.
Cool.
Well, oh, and actually, can I plug one more since I am on?
Absolutely.
Or actually, two more. There's since this is a paranormal and fantasy and sci-fi channel, you'd probably be intrigued by the Nightfall duology that just came out, which is now my longest audiobook longest single audiobook to date at 37 plus hours.
Oh my God.
Now, technically that's because it's two books in one volume, but it was released as one title. So, and that was done entirely in British, various British dialects. So you can either, you'll either love it or you'll scoff. But actually it's one of those just in intricate world building type fantasy novels with a really good message at the heart of it.
Nice. And that was Nightfall Duology?
Nightfall. Yeah. Oh, and the key thing, yeah, the Nightfall Duology.
Okay.
And what made it unique was that our main character, Nightfall, is an assassin who always lives incognito. And he, whenever he's in a different land, he has a different alias. So the same character, I gave him about six different voices and accents, depending on what guise he was in. And then a lot of the time, he was never in his true guise, but we get his thoughts. So his thoughts, I had to give, you know, we have his inner voice, had yet another voice. And it only comes out when he's truly being himself, which is rare.
Wow.
So that was fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been really cool to work on.
So that and Live from New York is the other one that it's not new, but I think its sales are really picking up for it, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And that is co-narrated with Christina Delane, and it's the whole history of Saturday Night Live from its inception all the way up to about 2 years ago. And almost the whole book is interview quotes by everybody affiliated with the show.
Oh my gosh.
And you can imagine the challenge there. And we were pointedly told, don't impersonate,
yeah,
but do keep the sense of humor and, you know, do try to tell, keep the spirit of the jokes of the show alive.
But don't try to sound like them.
But yeah, don't impersonate. But if you could differentiate the voices, that would be great.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So how do you read Christopher Walken without reading Christopher Walken?
Oh, well, you know, how do you?
You do another kind of voice that's, you know, you do what Paul does, which is you think of Christopher Walken and then it doesn't come out like that at all.
Oh my gosh. That sounds awesome.
Actually, I have a little clip from it from the intro on my SoundCloud page. And if you want to hear how I approached it, because that intro was retelling some of the most famous jokes, all one after the other, like Sarah Palin's, I can see Russia from my house, and I can't believe I'm losing to this guy. John Lovett says Dukakis, and so on.
Yeah.
You know, you give a flavor, but you don't, I try not to do the voices, just maybe the tonality of how different people would speak.
Yeah. Yeah. Know? We'll include a link to your SoundCloud page in the show notes. Great. Yeah.
I guess I'm done plugging. I sorry if I didn't mean to overwhelm.
No, that's awesome.
Books out there.
Oh, that's cool. Thank you so much for chatting with me tonight.
Oh, sure, James. It's always a pleasure.
I have had a blast, and hopefully either maybe volume 3 of Jules de Grandin. More Soul Eater, or
I decided to go unlike my pronunciation of Van Gogh, I did try to go for the French, the accurate de Grandin.
Well, you know, he was French, so
he was.
But yeah, you know, it's, or God, any number of other books that you're going to be working on. It sounds like I'm going to want to have you back, and I hope you say yes.
I hope so.
Cool, cool.
Well, thanks for having me for this first season of yours.
Yeah,
first of many. I hope.
knock on wood, is that appropriate here? I don't have anything wooden, but you know,
I'll knock for leather.
Thanks. Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And as always, a very special shout out to our Patreon patrons. There's C. Stephen Manley, Colleen O'Malley Jackson, Mike Johnson, Audiobooks After Dark, Zachary McElroy, and Dogan Foster. If you enjoy this podcast and you'd like to lend your support and get your name mentioned at the end of an episode like this, all you have to do is head over to patreon.com/sorceress and sign up to support us at the wisecracking wizarding level or higher. Thank you so much. And that's it for this time. Thanks for dropping by. We really hope you enjoyed it and will come back and see us again.
You can find Sorceress on iTunes, Stitcher, and our website, Sorceress. That's Sorcero.us. And you can find me at jamesnarrates.com, where you'll find a list of audiobooks, demos, and all the usual stuff. If you're enjoying Sorceress, please leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher, and if you're really enjoying it, it'd be mighty kind of you to drop a buck or two in the kitty. You can make a per-episode donation by signing up at patreon.com/sorceress, or you can make a one-time donation by visiting paypal.me/jamesnarrates. Any support, no matter how small, is greatly appreciated, and it'll help us keep on keeping on. So until next time, when things go bump in the night, remember to bump back.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.